Good morning, folks. Boker Tov, Shabbat Shalom, and welcome back. This portion is yet another one of these in the sequence that begin the book of Deuteronomy that are, I would say, absolutely crucial and really, really outline some things, especially this week, because in this portion, which is Re'eh, and that word literally means behold, or open your eyes, look, see, check it out, folks. The verse begins this way, behold, this is from Moses who is speaking, I set before you this day the choice. Ultimately, it's the choice of Torah, between a blessing and a curse. Life and death, blessing and cursing. This theme is repeated throughout the book of Deuteronomy. It's key, and of course, you've probably heard me say this. I think ultimately, if you're looking for a two-word summary of Torah, choose life. Is about as close to the gist of it in a couple of words as you're going to get. Choose life. Choose who you serve. There's a lot of ways of phrasing it. We see most of them in this book. But nevertheless, this is the beginning of the place where we start to see the idea of I set before you this day a blessing and a curse. So look, check it out, open your eyes, behold, Re'eh. And oh, did we mention there are, I wouldn't call them strings attached, but there are certainly conditions. The blessing that you shall hearken to the commandments of Yahuwah Eloheka, which I command you this day. The curse if you will not hearken. And as I mentioned, I'm not going to belabor it. I spent some time talking about it last night again. But ultimately, the right way to translate this, says the Hebrew scholar Rashi from a long, long time ago, is the blessing that you shall hearken, and the curse if you don't hearken. What's the difference? Well, the difference is when it says it the way it says it here, it means the blessing comes right up front, and the curse follows if you are in rebellion. So it's kind of an indication of good faith on his part. He's going to bless us anyway, and given that we know we're blessed, well then, as Paul likes to put it, what is our reasonable service? Answer? Well, to be of service to him, to walk in obedience. If you love me, keep my commandments. There's a lot of ways of saying it. But that is the central way that this portion starts out. And, there's this one other thing, too, that is key. Because what is associated with the curse? Why is the curse? What's he talking about here? The blessing, if you will hearken. Shamar, listen, and obey. All the things that get emphasized over and over and over and over again for reasons that should be obvious, and if they're not, we'll talk about those in a minute. But the curse, if you will not hearken, but turn aside out of the way that I command you, and do what? Instead, go after other gods that you have not known. So let's outline the rest of the kind of central concepts to Re'eh up front this morning, and we'll talk about some very specific things that this implies. One, there's a choice. Blessing and cursing, life and death. Two, kind of the other side of the choice, idolatry. This idea of idolatry is intimately and infinitely wrapped up with the choice. Idolatry leads to death. It leads to service to another god. And furthermore, it's clear that is why he hates it so viscerally. And we see that in chapter 12. I'm skipping through and just going to hit a couple of highlights to make these points. These are the statutes and the ordinances which you shall do in the land, he says, and utterly destroy all these places where the nations that you're dispossessing serve their gods. Dash in pieces their pillars. Break down their altars. Burn their asherim. Hew down their graven images. These are not only action words, they are viscerally, emotionally active words. Leave no doubt about it, kind of action words. Don't do any of this stuff to Yahuwah Eloheka or claim that you're doing it on his behalf or for him. He hates it. From there, we see a number of things in this portion. I'm just going to outline them briefly. I'm going to suggest if you think about it, and we will, all of these things are very much intimately related to what we're talking about. For example, slavery. There's a concept of slavery, or at least bond service. We need to distinguish between Hebrew bond service, the kind of thing that Torah talks about, and the outright abject slavery that the prince of this world and those who serve him intend to bind people in. It was what they were delivered from by a mighty hand out of the, one of the kingdoms of this world, Egypt, Mitzrayim. And, of course, we have Lots of references to that in the scriptures, as well as Babylon. And we got modern Babylon and modern Egypt and all the various, princes of this world that still represent those very same forces serving the very same alternative fake pagan gods. So slavery is one of the consequences of a choice. We can be in a servitude relationship to the Most High, which is a good thing and brings life, or we can be in abject slavery to the nastiest, most evil big brother you can imagine, and ain't nothing changed. Same old. Solomon had it right. Nothing new under the sun. There are some other things, if we make the right choice, that we will also see kind of follow, like this idea of charity, lending to your brother, doing the right thing. In other words, let's do the gift thing, the blessing thing, the take care of our neighbor thing, the way that the Creator says, or I guess the alternative is the communist, socialist, fascist, ist, statist thing that also represents service to the prince of this world. I gave it the office. He has his own way of giving, and guess what? He takes the credit, and you don't get any blessing from it. It's just taken from you. There's a real interesting point to that, but still, when you step back and look at it, it's all about the original choice. Behold, open your eyes, see, choose idolatry and service to another set of gods, and of course, the death that comes along with it, or choose to serve Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and ideally, him alone, because you can't serve two masters. Finally, it ends up with another theme that shows up throughout here, if we make the right choice. Rejoice, rejoice, rejoice. Over and over again, whether it's bringing the offerings and having a great, big, wonderful barbecue, or all of his appointed times, no, they're not the Jewish feasts. They're not the done-away feasts that Roman pagan Catholicism and all of those other religions of, as it turns out, the prince of this world, too, whether they know it or not, are pushing. Christmas, we've got a holiday weekend coming up. Ain't that holy? But if we keep his feasts, he says, there'll be rejoicing involved. And that's a big part of the whole equation. So all of this fits together and literally underlines and outlines this idea of the choice. And the implications are clear. But I think the key word is the way the parsha begins. Re'eh, behold, I have set this before you. Check it out. This is the same choice. And furthermore, this choice goes probably a lot further back. Ultimately, this may not surprise too many folks if you think about it. It goes all the way back to Genesis chapter, especially chapter 3, but it's hinted at and outlined in chapter 2, right? Basically, before Adam even takes Chava Eve from, or has Eve taken from her by the Creator, it says in Genesis 2:17 the following. Let's read that one just to make this idea of the choice clear. And Yahuwah Eloheka commanded the man, saying, hey, look at that. Check it out. Behold, of all of the trees in the garden, you can freely eat. But there's one. This tree, now the Bible actually in the King James here says it's called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That's how everybody's heard it said, right? The apple tree, the tree of the fruit, and you've seen the pictures, right? We got a major international corporation that has a symbol saying, yeah, just like the old Nahash, the serpent of old, here's this wonderful symbolizing us. And that's, an apple with a bite out of it. How clever. How, downright satanic. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil. On the day that you eat of that, he says, you shall surely die. Now, I like the Hebrew here, but basically the rendering, if you look at the Hebrew word, it's mot are the root forms that appear here, mot. And another way to think of it, and this is a way that some translations will render, dying, you shall die. I like the Hebrew emphasis. When it's emphasizing something, you see the same word repeated. And that's really a cool way to put it. It's not just that you will surely die. It's dying, you shall die. Are you getting the idea? This tree is about death. Now, why am I making this point? I've got an article here, a Midrash, from, again, another one of my favorites. This guy's name is Rabbi Ari Kahn. And he, too, like so many people, sees the obvious that the Torah is about choice. And the fact that Elohim, the Creator, has given man choice is the essence of this idea that, philosophers and people have argued about for, forever. Free will. What is free will? You got ex-gens that will argue about Calvinism. Do we have free will? Well, Scripture makes it real clear. Yes, we do. Man has given us a choice. Yes, he foreknew us. Yes, he knows what choice probably we're going to make. But the essence of it is, it's still up to us to make the choice. So, we have choices. They're described as, variously, blessings, curses, life or death. And here is the part where I think Rabbi Kahn makes an interesting observation. And I'm going to take the same point in a second and kind of repeat something I mentioned last night, another way of looking at it. Remarkably, he says, mankind has always needed to be encouraged to do something you'd think would be downright obvious. Choose life. The seemingly automatic, you know, brain dead, anybody could see it, choice, rational choice, has never been the kind of no-brainer that it ought to be, though. Why would any sane person choose a curse path that leads to certain death over the blessings of the path that leads to life? Evidently, there's something more to it here. It must be more complicated. Clearly, our judgment has been somehow clouded. Because from time immemorial, and here's why I like this phrasing, he says, the tree of death and its luscious fruit looked like the gleaming and attractive choice. It's delicious, more desirable, right? What do we hear in chapter 3? Oh, Chava Eve looked at this fruit and it was good looking, desirable to eat, wonderful. Good. It's good. Take a big old bite out of the tree of death. And in addition, the seductive serpentine salesman hissed in our ears about how it's really wonderful. It'll solve all your problems, enlighten the power you, give you knowledge and understanding, all this good stuff. In other words, folks, it's all about marketing. And I think that's really the cool way to put it. The tree of death is what is really being described here. But even in the way that it gets translated into the English, there is a whole marketing thing going on. It's not the tree of death, even though that is clearly the way that Moat, dying you shall die, says what it is. It was indeed, says Rabbi Kahn, a tree of death, and it was presented that way by Elohim himself as the very antithesis of the tree of life. So, clearly though, in order for man to make a choice, and at least have the choice look something different, the tree needed a more palatable image. Again, marketing needs to be presented as the tree of knowledge of good and evil rather than of what it really is, the tree of death. I guess I want to do this next story because this caught my eye. I know this sounds like it's a bit off topic for a second, but while we're thinking about marketing, how is it that you sell people on something which leads directly to death? And we've already seen Scripture lay it out. It's got to do with making it seem attractive somehow. It's pretty. It appeals to the eye. Now, I have another way of looking at this, too. I think there's something else going on here. It also appeals to the get it now, the immediacy aspect. In other words, as the choice gets closer and the consequences get further. By the way, I realize as I'm saying this, I'm literally paraphrasing something that Solomon said in the book of Ecclesiastes. I think it's 8:11, as a matter of fact. The consequences of evil actions are delayed. There's a lag, so people just don't get it. They don't connect the dots. They don't see the consequences. Otherwise, they'd know. It was a stupid choice. In other words, we're talking about something that some of the sociologists will call time preference. I want it now. I don't care about death tomorrow. I want my drug hit today. I want my coke, my heroin, my whatever. I want my gay sex in the Chicago bathhouse. I don't care about the fact that I will die tomorrow. Tomorrow we die anyway. Ha ha, right? Ultimately, Scripture is talking, I think, a little bit about that choice too. Are we focused on the here and the now and the hell with tomorrow? Because tomorrow, you know, that's where we're at, is a living hell. Or are we focused on what he would like us to be focused on, which is the more permanent situation, life that really is life? Notice, of course, that even when it comes to Adam v'Chava, Adam and Eve, it's on the day you shall die, and we know that that was, in fact, a thousand-year day, it would seem. So, same choice as always is the key here, and this tree is appealing, even though it is the tree of death. Now, here's the story from this week. This is from the Free Thought Project's Matt Agorist, and you're not going to believe the headline. but maybe you will. It says here, last week a Miami-Dade judge ruled that the government, Octoon, can ban vegetable gardens because they're ugly. Now think about that. Apples are pretty. That fruit, that's really appealing. Eat that and die. But organic vegetable gardens, the judge says, are ugly. So the village of Miami Shores, according to this recent ruling, has every right to take legal action against the peons who think they own property there and try to grow food in their own yards because they're ugly. This was a 10-page whopping ruling that has been the focus of much-deserved anger. And what they said is banning front yard vegetable gardens is something that the city is just plain, well, it's within its God-given rights to do. Even though Judge Monica Gordo, which means fat in Spanish, and I think it seems appropriate. Anyway, I don't know whether she's really fat or not, but her brain seems to be infected with a lot of fat. She acknowledged she still wasn't quite sure how a vegetable garden can ruin the aesthetics of what one thought they were their own property. But hey, the real key is she's acknowledging what those that are paying attention already know. If a municipality can come in and tell you what color you have to paint it and whether you get to grow something in what you thought was your property or not, guess what? It's not your property. She says that democratically elected government has every right to dictate what constitutes ugly. Now, the story here seems to think there's a big difference about the fact that this is talking about the front yard, not the backyard. And I'm going to ask the question, who says? Today, the front yard, tomorrow, the side yards, Tuesday, the backyards. If they have the ability to say what you can and can't put in any of what you thought was your yard, you don't own any of it. Let's not kid ourselves. Anyway, given the degree of deference that must be given to governments, the ban on vegetable gardens outside of the backyard passes constitutional scrutiny, the fat one wrote. This was based on a 3-year-long legal battle so far between Tom Carroll and Hermione Ricketts. They face a fine of $50 a day. $50 a day. That's $1,500 a month. I bet you they could probably rent a place for a lot less than that. Anyway, not because they robbed banks or trafficked in humans or committed sex crimes or some other criminal enterprise, no, but because they're trying to grow their own organic food. They've been doing this for 17 years until one day the state came knocking. No one was harmed, get this, by the couple's garden. It was entirely organic. They didn't spray it. They weren't causing any problems. And in the nearly 2 decades that they've been doing this, not one of their neighbors ever complained. The only injured party was the almighty God of the state. Are you beginning to see the connection here? Behold, open your eyes. Take a look. There's a prince of this world who wants life, and he wants you to eat from the tree of death. And then there is the alternative who says, choose life and have it more abundantly through him. Attorney for the tyrannical city of Miami Shores said, quote, there certainly is not a fundamental right to grow vegetables in your front yard or indeed in any of our property. Aesthetics and uniformity are legitimate government purposes. Octung, not every property can lawfully be used for every purpose, unquote, unless, of course, you're the almighty state, in which case you decide you can poison people's bees. We had that story too, right? Safe Zika pesticide nukes millions of bees in South Carolina, where Dorchester County officials said, oops, sorry about that. CDC said it was safe. Bees won't die. Well, whole lots of them just died. A lot of beekeepers are upset. And the county official responsible for the latest bee side said, I'm not pleased that so many bees were killed. But hey, you know, what the heck? You want to make an omelet, you got to break a few eggs, kill a few bees. Somehow or other, folks, it seems to me like I step back. Let's just step back a second and look at this. The whole Torah portion is called Re'e. Behold, open your eyes, take a look. I have laid before you life and blessing, death and cursing. Make the choice. Oh, and don't choose the idolatry, the fake gods of this world, because that brings death. Dying, you shall die. There's a fruit here that is of the tree of life, and then there's this other one, the tree of death, but marketing is everything. Eat from that one, says the bad guy, the prince of this world. And this same old story just keeps repeating. I mean, literally, you can take this book and you can hold it up and say there is a singular story that's being told. Will we choose life or will we choose death? And basically, idolatry is at the root of it. Which master are you going to serve? One that says, get it now, it's pretty, it's desirable, looky here, you can't wait, oh yeah, go, dying you shall die, but man, what a great ride until you get there. Or the alternative, life and death, blessing and cursing, obedience or rebellion, who will you serve? Will you eat the good-looking but deadly fruit? Or can government, just simply because it's an idolatrous thing anyway, ban vegetable gardens from its property because they're ugly? We don't like them. I bet you the fruit of the tree of life is not real attractive, at least not to the eye. Interesting. What I want to do is talk about one or two more other things to set all the things we're going to spend some time on today up. Because, again, part of what I'm going to contend is that we are facing a choice. The choice is literally slamming down the tracks, kind of like a freight train. You can see that light in the distance. It's getting closer by the second. And there's a train whistle blowing, or a shofar. Maybe it's hard to tell the difference sometime. I want to look at one more story. By the way, this is by the same author. And it's a little different aspect of the Torah portion, but it fits. This one is called, got a clever title. You may remember the Tom Cruise movie called, Cuba Gooding Jr. He was a sports agent. Yeah, the phrase is show me the money, but I can't think of the name of the movie. Anyway, that was it. Show me the money! And really, if you think about it, that's not show me the money in modern terms. It's show me the kasef. I want to see the kasef. Anyway, so here's how this one begins. It's about creating, as they put it, a just society. Justice, justice, you shall pursue. Seems like somehow or other this concept of justice is also tied up in the same choice, right? Between life and blessing, death and cursing, idolatry, the prince of this world, or the real creator and author of scripture and master of the universe. And of course, whether or not we will choose his justice, his choice of law, or we'll say, oh, the law is all done away with. Let's go to that hell in the handbasket place where law means what I want it to mean today. Ha ha! And you can't own property. In this week's Torah reading, it says, Moshe is preparing the nation that is now getting ready to go across the Jordan River and into the land for their new life. In the land, the promised land. And he warns them. He warns them over and over and over and over and over again, too. Do not follow the practices of the local pagans, the ones that are getting kicked out. They're fake gods. And they worship all these different deities under every green tree. There's an interesting connection there too, isn't it, right? Instead, they're going to have a single place of worship. It'll be the place where Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh puts his name, and that's where they will bring all their offerings, and in fact, they'll do so with joy, joyfully. They'll rejoice. All right. Now, there's a lot more in the portion. He spends some time talking about things that I'm going to just kind of include in the general milieu of where we're headed and say this. They were heading into the land. They were warned. Where are we today? Well, there are some people in the land. The land has not reached either the boundaries or the blessings that were once in place. There are some indications that it's at least now something we can look forward to. But most of us, especially Israel, the northern kingdom, the 10 tribes, the various flavors of pagan ex-Christianity, as I often point out, all that Romanized, paganized, universal, a.k.a. Catholic stuff, where they got a man that tells them what God got right and what God got wrong, just like, well, same old, same old. And he's still at it, by the way. The newest one is probably one of the most evil of an evil crew. But if we have time, we'll come back to that. Anyway, the question is, what about the land itself? How do people merit the land of Israel? Clearly, if we get kicked out over and over again, that happened to both the northern and southern kingdoms, there's a problem. And we were warned. Moshe made it clear. The prophets made it clear, every single one of them. How do we merit the land of Israel, says this guy and literally just about everybody else that's ever approached the question. How do we merit that? Well, we choose life. We walk in obedience. And in this portion, there are a whole bunch of things make that clear. But Here's the line that I'm going to pick out of this entire story. Listen to this. But we must do more than merely eschew idolatry. We must create a just society. Says this teacher. We must do more than eschew idolatry. We must create a just society. I'm going to stop and say, wait a second. No, time out. I started today by saying, we have this choice. Life and blessing, death and cursing, idolatry versus service to the Most High. Slavery or freedom, release from bondage. You know what else? Justice, justice you shall pursue. Isn't that exactly part of what it means to keep His commandments? That's the essence of it. How do we know what justice is? Answer is written down for us in genuine print, the Torah. How do we eschew idolatry and in the process create a just society? Hey, you know what? Pause. Take a deep breath. It is exactly the same thing. You cannot create a justice society, a just society. There's a just us society we see in America today. Look who's, you know, the slam dunk choice, at least up until they kill her, for president. Justice, justice you shall pursue. Well, in the world where the pagan idolatry rules, it's just us. If we eschew idolatry, it's the very same thing as pursuing Him, His word, His instruction, His leadership, walking in service to Him, and the just society is a, you know, necessary result of that. And we failed, and we got kicked out of the land. In other words, these are just two different ways, and there are others in this portion too, of saying exactly the same thing. You serve the God of this world, guess what the last thing you're ever going to have is? It's a just society. You get the Department of Just Us. And ultimately, and this is the part where I go to another story that I mentioned yesterday. Now, this one came from Rabbi David Foreman's crew. And I like what they say, but I did take a little bit of an objection to the way that they phrased it last night. And it was a good instruction. Like I said, I picked on them a bit, and I'm not really picking on them directly. I'm picking on a society where this can be stated. Because what they said is, look, the Hebrew word for what is being prohibited here is avodah zarah, the worship of foreign gods. Idolatry, paganism, the worship of foreign gods, avodah zarah. And what is so attractive about that? Now, here's how they put it. They said, well, you know, we don't get it. Because people look at the world today and they say, well, that was then, right? That was back in Old Testament times. Worship of foreign gods. We're too smart for that now. We worship our iPods, our Channel 9, and our gods of Washington who give us all the goodies, from the Obama phones to aid to families with dependent children to our monthly checks for everything you can imagine and a whole bunch of stuff you probably can't. No, those are the gods we worship. Those are modern gods. We don't even call them gods because, well, you know, hey, come to think of it, kind of harkens back to that tree thing. It's all about marketing. We've been marketed a whole set of foreign gods and they're not even called that. So it's not really worshiping foreign gods. No, we're just worshiping the gods of this land. You know, the ones that rule over us and that tell us you don't own property and you can't put a vegetable garden in our front yard. You pee on, you slave you. We are the gods who tell you. We tell you what kesef is. Show me the money. No, you don't even see the money because you ain't privileged enough to know what it is. In this choice of law, these foreign gods, we don't have what the Bible calls money anymore at all. And by the way, what the supreme law once called. You know, it's just astounding. And this is the thing I'm trying to emphasize. I want to try to paint this picture in several different ways. We've come so far down this path. We don't recognize anymore that the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, we're being sold knowledge all the time. Knowledge abounds. We got more knowledge at our fingertips. Why, we can choose death in a thousand different ways with a single keystroke. And Google will make sure that the, you know, once you make the choice, they record it for all time. Unless you're, you know, above the law, in which case your emails can be disappeared. We're talking about the very same thing, phrased 100 different ways. Fake gods, the prince of this world, choosing death versus choosing life, idolatry, slavery, you name it. So the question, why was Avodah Zarah, the worship of foreign gods, so attractive then, is almost stunning in its simplicity and in its literal blindness. Because I think probably the vast majority of Americans would say, oh, foreign gods? We don't worship foreign gods. And I step back and I shake my head and I say, oh, for crying out loud. Talk about having chosen their delusions. I'm going to telegraph one more thing here because some of you are probably thinking, oh, is Mark going to go to Isaiah 66 again? Yeah, but I have a good excuse for today in addition to the Torah portion. Guess what? Now, this only happens about every third or fourth year or so. I haven't actually gone through the math, but in discussions this week with the other part of the crew that does the Torah Teachers Roundtable. As you know, Brother Rob, the fellow who is a little bit more rabbinic in his orientation than I am, admittedly, and that's just great. I love the diversity of opinions. Even though we agree on the essential things, we have some disagreements about the minor stuff. That's wonderful. Love Rob, too. Anyway, he pointed out that if you look at the rabbinic understandings of which Haftorah portions go with the various Torah portions, and of course we do this show every week called the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Haftorah Edition. Well, is it going to be this week? Are we talking about Isaiah 54 and 55? Because that's one of the places that it sometimes comes from. Or maybe it's Isaiah 66. They do kind of go together. But anyway, it turns out that this year, the Torah portion is not what it might have been in other years, but it is, in fact, Isaiah 66. So, yeah, the key word out of here, and we'll come back to it. We're going to spend some time on it a little bit later and in more detail, because I oftentimes just quote the key verse there. Because when I called, no one answered. They chose that in which I do not delight. Hey, idolatry, wrong gods, death, you name it. I will also choose their delusions. You fell for the marketing. Now you're buying the farm, right? You're buying the whole hog. You bought the lemon car, whatever analogy you want to use. That's what we're talking about. So there we go. The idea of Isaiah 66 and the delusion is on the table too. We literally have a choice. Because you have rejected knowledge, said the prophet Hosea, I will reject you from being priest for me, and oh, that ain't enough. I'm going to forget your children too. We see how all of this stuff seems to essentially, if we really step back, teaching us the same thing. There's a choice. It's a real simple choice. Life and death, blessing or cursing, obedience and rebellion. And that also has to do with choice of law. In other words, which God do you serve? The real one or any number of fakes? There might be hundreds of different names for it, him, they. Doesn't matter. It's all adversarial. Ha, Satan, right? If you want to use that way of putting it. It's all anything else but the one. Let me read one more quick commentary. This, again, it kind of makes the point that we're already making, but I want to throw this into the mix. Having set out the broad principles of the covenant, says another teaching, another one of my favorites, the fellow from Britain, Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks. Moshe now turns to the details, and this takes a number of parashot. The long review of the various statutes and judgments and commandments that will govern Israel in the land. And they begin and they end with this idea of the momentous choice. In this week's portion, he says, I'm setting before you today, see, behold, a blessing and a curse. Blessing that you obey the commands, the curse if you disobey, and in the process follow other gods. All right, that's Deuteronomy 11, 26 through 28. And then we skip to the end of the book, almost the very end. Deuteronomy chapter 30, this is probably one of my favorite verses in all of Scripture. See, again, behold, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil, and furthermore, heaven and earth are being called as witnesses against you, to show you that I've set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. So, choose life. I joke about it. It's an open book test. Here's the answer. So choose life, that you and your descendants might live. Two-word summary of Torah, right? Choose life. All of these are quoted by people, great sages of the past that most Torah-obedient Jews would know, names like the Rambam, Maimonides, who takes those two passages as proof of the concept of free will. Now, here's where I think the Rabbi Sachs adds an interesting twist in. I've already kind of touched on this. That's part of the reason why I picked it out. These things, this idea of life and blessing, death and cursing, choose, are also a political statement. Now, this is an interesting observation. I don't know that I completely agree with some of the rabbinic implications, but I think it's an important thing to at least put on the table, too, as we're getting started today. This connection between individual freedom, things Maimonides is talking about, and a collective choice, which Moshe seems to be talking about, is this. If humans are free, then they need a free society within which to exercise this freedom. That is what the book of Devarim represents. Okay, interesting point. The book of Devarim is the first attempt in recorded history to create a free society. First attempt in recorded history to create a free society. Now, I read that and I thought, you know, no wonder. No wonder the Romanized, paganized church hates that old, done away with, law is nailed to the cross thing so badly, because it reveals just how big the lie is, how deep the rabbit hole goes, right? Deuteronomy 30 begins with, is this really that hard for you? One of the tenets of pagan ex-Christianity is, you've heard this before, right? Nobody can keep the law. Why, the law is horrible, bad. That's why it was done away with. Only Jesus could keep the law. Bull. I've said this before. Read what Deuteronomy 30 says. Let me read it. Is it across the ocean? Is it really that hard? Well, you know what the author named Paul or Shaul says? He says, you know what? Let God be true and every man a liar. I'm going to say there's a whole lot of lying going on. When people tell you it's too hard to keep the law, don't even try. Now, they're also lying about what the meaning of the word, it all depends on what the meaning of the word law is. If the law is everything that all of these evil men who add to and subtract from it, by the way, that's in this week's Torah portion too, say it is, right? 1,700 rules for what you can and can't do on the Sabbath. Catholics say, oh, well, it's anathema to keep the Sabbath. We might just kill you. And indeed, they did for centuries. And just to make sure that you understand that, well, you don't have a copy of scriptures. That too, for centuries, carried a death penalty. And we just heard this Pope say it again not long ago. Well, you peons, you can't read the Bible. You need a priest to interpret it for you. Because you might get the idea that when God says something, he actually means that. Well, like, the law isn't done away with. He says it's perpetual. Keep it throughout your generations and all your dwelling places. Keep all my statutes, judgments, and commandments. He says it about a half a dozen times in this portion alone. Well, it's still too hard for you. You can't possibly do it. Well, it depends. Which law are we talking about? Yours, Mr. Pope? Yours, Mr. Chief Rabbi? Or the one that wrote it down for us in genuine print, the Creator, who said in Deuteronomy chapter 30, this isn't that hard. He'll circumcise your heart and the heart of your descendants to love him with all your heart and with all your soul that you may live. And you'll do all of this stuff. And furthermore, don't think that the one that brought you out of captivity and had compassion on you can't gather you again. Hey, that's us. To all the places he scattered all of us. If any of us are driven to the furthest parts of heaven, yep, he can bring us back from there into the land. We'll possess it. He'll circumcise our heart, put these curses on our enemies and those who hated us and persecuted us, and we will again be able to obey the voice of Yahuwah and do all the commandments. Will abound, all this good stuff. Verse 10 says this, if you obey the voice of Yahuwah and keep his commandments and his statutes, which are written in this book of the Torah, if you turn to Yahuwah with all your heart and with all your soul, well, no problem. Because, why? Verse 11, here's the part that ought to be highlighted in, you know, bright, red, flashing commandments. Anytime somebody lies to you and tells you you can't keep it. Verse 11 says this. This is one of those places I say, hey, you tell me, I can't do it. He says I can. Excuse me, but I choose to believe the creator of the universe rather than you and your pagan gods that say otherwise. Quote, for this commandment, which I command you today, is not too mysterious for you, not too hard for you, nor is it far off. It's not up in heaven that you need to say, who will ascend and bring it to us that we may do it? Nor is it on the other side of the sea that you say, who will go over the sea to us, bring it back to us that we may hear it and do it? Nope. He says, it is very near to you. It's in your mouth and in your heart that you may do it. And then he repeats again, behold, see, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil. How many times, how many ways does he need to say it? And it's not too hard for us. It's just that we've been lied to. We've inherited lies from our fathers. We're told all of these things. We are, in fact, know it or not, serving fake gods, the prince of this world, and all of those who serve him, who since the beginning have been saying, look at this tree of death. Oh, man. Some kind of shiny fruit. You want your Apple Mac or your Apple iPhone or iPad or your Obama iPhone? Look at that wonderful little symbol right there on the side of it. Shows you what we're talking about. Take a big old bite out of the tree of death. Am I picking on Apple? No, I'm just picking on the particular corporate culture that thinks that a symbol of eating something that leads to death somehow symbolizes what it is they want to drive people to accept. Call me cynical and sarcastic on that score. There are so many implications, but all of this, whether we're talking slavery or bondage, choice of law, show me the money as opposed to show me the fake stuff that in fact is an abomination to him. Same old, same old, same old. It's not too hard. There's a choice. Behold, it's really simple. It's open book. Choose life. And it all boils down to those two words. Back to this concept that the rabbi lays out here. The book of Devarim, Deuteronomy, represents the first, huh? Jerry Maguire. Thank you. The name of the movie. Somebody put it on the screen? Okay. That's why I couldn't think of it. So, Show Me the Money. Movie is called Jerry Maguire. Anyway, the book of Devarim represents first attempt to create a free society. I tried to illustrate it back to the point here that is why you fail. No, that is why it would seem that so much of ex-Chianity wants to claim this book is all done away. Don't you dare read that Old Testament. Oh, for crying out loud, don't read Deuteronomy because you might stumble across 30:11 that says we're liars and the truth is not in us and that it's not that hard and that you can in fact do it. Or we're trying to sell you this already bitten into apple of death that says it's done away with. The law's done away with. His arm is short. He can't do it. Dying, you shall die. No, don't live by any of that. Don't pay any attention. You know what? All of that is just another restatement of the first two big lies right out of Genesis chapter 3. You will not die. Hey, you can be like gods. You too can rewrite the law. Claim that it's done away with. Now, I'll finish this quick story from Jonathan Sacks, because he says Moses insists in his speech, and this is part of another summary of Re'eh, on three main things. First, understand this. We are free. The choice is ours. Blessing or curse, good and evil, life or death. Who do you choose to obey? You decide, says Moshe. But this is what they point to as a slightly different thing. As a nation, Moshe is also speaking to Kol Israel, all of Israel. Now, what I think is key to all of this, and this is the place where I part company a little bit with some of the collectivist mindset. Yes, it's important what Kol Israel does. It is, in fact, Kol Israel that was kicked out of the land, along with Kol of the nation of Judah, the southern kingdom. So there are, in fact, you know, the rain falls on the just and the unjust. When bad things happen, yep, the fallout tends to hit all kinds of folks. But we still have an individual choice. And when he addresses us collectively, he's also addressing us individually. We can choose this day whom we will serve. We can choose to come out of her if we're one of my people, as he puts it. We can avoid participating in the sins so that we do not partake of the plagues. We saw that with the plagues in Egypt. There were a few that were visited on everybody, but after a while, those that were in Goshen, that were of Israel, didn't suffer the same way those that were still in Egypt did. So, here's this statement. To be told this is a nation by Moshe, this is what's new here. Because we already know that choice is part of the equation. Choose life, choose death. But there's no defense, said Moshe, if we try to claim something like the following. We couldn't help it! I voted for Hitlery, but that bad guy Trump won. Or, I voted for Trump, but Hitlery won. Came and took my guns and killed my family and sent me to a concentration camp. Here I am, oh, woe is me. Guess God can't help me. We were outnumbered. We were defeated. It's not my fault. It's all those bad guys. It's the Democrats. It's the Republicans. It's the Socialists. It's the Communists. It's the National Labor Party. Pick your country. Pick your excuse. Whine, whine, whine. Jezebel did it. Ahab did it. No, says Moses, understand this. Your fate is in your hands. The sovereignty of Elohim does not take away human responsibility. That is a vital understanding. Yeah. Some of you know that I despise the term that the FBI wants to try to label everybody who's ever read a Bible or a Constitution or think that the law might actually apply to all of the people that are supposedly putting their hands on Bibles and swearing to uphold it. They call them sovereign citizens. Well, excuse me, there's one sovereign. His name is Yahuwah, and it ain't you. And it's not me either. Sovereign citizen, my you-know-what. What a crock. There is one sovereign in the universe. You want his protection, you serve him. You choose to serve any other god? I'll tell you what, you ain't sovereign, and you're sure as hell not serving him, and you don't have his protection. But you do and will have your reward. Yeshua makes some claims that are very much like that, too. They've made their choice. They've made their bed. They lie in it. These are really, really old and ultimately universal and, yes, scriptural principles. No, Moses is right. Your fate is in your hands. The sovereignty of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh does not take away human responsibility. To do what? To choose life. To the contrary, it's center stage. If you are faithful to him, says Moshe, you will prevail over enemies. Period. We're going to see that when we turn back to Isaiah 66. We see it throughout Scripture. We saw it. It was proved to the people that Moshe was talking to. He tells them. We just saw it the last couple weeks. Remember what happened to Og of Bashan, King of Sihon, all those other bad, nasty, big, scary dudes. They're worm fodder. You got no excuse saying they're bigger, more powerful than me. It's about who you serve. That's where the power lies, and that's where the blessing lies, or if you choose otherwise, the curse. If you're not, nothing. Nothing else, if you're not serving him, is going to matter. Not military strength, not the greatest, most powerful nation the world has ever known, not who you vote for, not who rules from Washington and gets their statues placed on the monuments and their pictures put on the fiat bucks that will later come, not political alliances. None of that's going to help you if you betray your unique promised destiny. If you worship the gods of the surrounding nations, again, you have your reward. Well, then you will become exactly like that. You'll suffer the fate of all of the other nations that we've seen throughout history who did that and that we're fixing to see again. The choice is yours. The responsibility is yours. Now, we are, in fact, he says, collectively responsible. All right. The fate of Israel depends on the response of Israel. All of you, we see at least a couple places in Scripture, from the heads of your tribes, your elders and your officers, down to the ones who hew the wood and draw the water. And here he makes an interesting observation. I think this is key. Remember, this is a British rabbi. Matter of fact, one of the chief of the British rabbis, Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, he says, this is a uniquely American understanding, has no counterpart in the vocabulary of British people. We the people is the term. We the people. Now, there's another term that he doesn't mention, and you may recall from the Revolutionary War era, no king, but King Jesus. Whether they understood his other real name in the Hebrew or not. The theory, the theme was at least that when a king shows himself by his actions, his fruit, to be a tyrant, he is not fit, this is right out of the Declaration, to be the ruler of a free people. And so these people have the obligation and the authority under their true Creator and by divine providence. There are four names used for Him in the Declaration. King, Judge, Lawgiver among them. They have the authority to throw off that leadership because government depends on the consent of the governed. And that is the origin of the term we the people. All right, the third of the things that Moshe points out, he says, is that all of this is God-centered politics. You go back to the ancient historian Josephus. There was no word for this in his language. So he had to coin one. He called it, and it's a Greek term, and that's part of the reason why I'm not real wild about it, theocracy. Why is theocracy, in my mind, not such a great term? Because there's lots of gods, so far as the Greeks are concerned. Theos, that any god will do. Well, that seems to be the modern idea, too. By the way, what they've done with it now, and he points this out, is much abused the term, taking it to mean what it does not, which is basically rule by clerics and priests, people who play God on TV. That was not what Israel was supposed to be either. In other words, the idea is not really theocracy where any old God will do. It's the one. And he likes this term, and it's still Greek, nomocracy, rule of laws and not of men. I think the key is to understand that the only true law is Torah, his rule. Again, choose this day whom you will serve. And the choice, when it comes down to politics, is of course about not only blessing and cursing, but slavery and bondage versus the kind of freedom that comes from being a bond servant to Him. And he points out, and I do too, that all of this is a voluntary covenant. That's what Moshe was talking about. Choose. Choose life. It's what we're still talking about. And it's part of the reason that when I wax into the more political aspects of this choice, I'll point out that if you register to vote and if you submit yourself to the authority of the Almighty State, and basically whether you understand it or not, what people are doing is saying, okay, look, I got this choice. Donald Trump over here, Hillary Clinton over here. I'm going to choose which CEO can better run my life than me. Hint, hint. If you go back and read the Constitution, it's obvious that if it ever applied, it sure as hell doesn't have anything to do with what is emanating out of Washington today. And we're going to talk about that in just a couple minutes. So if you understand that the implicit concept of choosing who will run your life, picking your God, is that, well, I can't do it myself. I am, in fact, incompetent, legally in need of representation, of power of attorney. So which God will run my life? A, it's not the God of the Bible, because by the very act of doing something he says not to do, I've entered into this deal with the devil. I'm saying, okay, I want Beelzebub. No, I want Cthulhu. I want the Norse gods. I want the Roman gods. Yeah. You cannot then say, I didn't like the God that I wanted didn't win. I'm backing out. Sorry, it's too late. Here's the key. When you choose to participate in a system that you already know is rigged, why are you going to argue about the outcome, which is exactly what the people that rigged the system wanted it to be anyway? Isn't that beginning to be a little bit more clear? All right, I'm going to pause and ask the following question. Do we have any questions at this point? And if I missed any, then I'll deal with them now. Because we're gonna shift gears just a bit here. I don't see any, right? Nothing scrolled off. We'll give people just a minute to put it in. Because I want to talk a little bit about, again, what's going on in the world. I am of the dramatic and increasingly stout opinion that things are rapidly coming to a head. We've been seeing this steady acceleration. And some of you that have a physics background know that acceleration is defined mathematically as the rate of change of velocity, right? We're speeding up, but we're speeding up and speeding up. Turns out that, and I remember asking this question in physics in high school, hey, wait, is there something that is a change in acceleration? Is there a yet another derivative? Of course there is. It's called jerk. Makes sense. When something is jerked, we have jerks running the jerk that's going on now. Well, in other words, what's happening is the rate of acceleration is increasing. It's not just things are getting faster at a constant rate. Things are getting faster, and the rate of things getting faster is getting faster, and even the rate at which they get faster and accelerate is getting faster still. Whoa. In other words, Once a train drives off a cliff, yeah, ain't no stopping it. Question. Okay, I'm not sure if I want to spend much time on this one, to be real, Bill Frank, on it. Are the Muslim followers of Allah, are they half brothers? I will simply say the following. They're clearly not following the God of the Bible. Like so many of the other things that I'm going to suggest we need to come out of, that's one. I don't care whether you call him Allah or Beelzebub or Satan or another Jesus whom we have not preached, or Obama or Hitlery or Adolf or Pol Pot, or you pick the dictator, insert the name. There are all kinds of examples throughout history of nations which have forgotten him and turned and served other gods, regardless of what they get called. But there is one and only one creator and author of Scripture, and he did the things he did for us, and he's laid out this real simple choice. Choose life, choose whom you will serve. And for the rest of us who recognize that we're in the wrong place, and that what we need to do is to separate ourselves, the choice right now includes come out of her, be separate, touch not the unclean thing. And that includes Allah and all of those who serve that particular fake god as well. Sure. Okay. Okay, question, are there fallen angels? Yeah. Most of them, well, no. I started to say most of them live in Washington. No, they're all over the place. There's just a lot of them in places like Washington and Chicago and all the major cities. But don't worry, there's tons of them in any number of places. All right, let me go back to where I really wanted to head, and that is let's talk about where we are and when we are. And, of course, remember the men of Issachar. They knew the times and the seasons. We had better know the times and the seasons because they are really coming to a head. And I'm going to kind of work up to several things. And, again, as with Re'e, behold, open your eyes, look and see this choice, the idolatry. So much of these things, whether we look at politics or economics or war or the world war or civil war, take your pick, it's all ultimately going to boil down to this very same choice. It really is that incredibly difficult and ultimately that incredibly simple. Choose life. Choose who we serve. And this chapter, this portion, this book, the bigger book, they all lay it out. And they give us examples, they give us prophecies, they give us the histories, the lives. But it does really, in so many respects, boil down to that choice. There is one and only one God. We can serve him. We can choose his choice of law. We can walk in obedience to him. We can get the blessings in advance that we serve him. Or dying, you shall die. So let's talk about one of the economic indicators. We're going to talk about a number of indicators that go back again to this idea of acceleration and even jerk. When we first reported about the imminent paralysis, says Zero Hedge, of an unknown number of global supply chains and a potential shock in worldwide trade, what are they talking about? Well, if you didn't hear it, one of the biggest shipping container companies in the world declared bankruptcy this week. Number 7 on the world shipping list, a company called Hanjin out of South Korea, asked for bankruptcy protection. Why is that a big deal? Didn't get much press coverage outside of the financial pages, right? Because this company carries about 8% of all trans-Pacific trade that comes from Asia to the U.S. market. Now, you know how much of our stuff comes from Asia to begin with. This is a big deal. The question that Zero Hedge, one of the few decent economic sources out there says, is just how bad are the ripple effects going to be, the dominoes? Answer, tremendous. World trade has already been dramatically impacted. In some places, even the right word is paralyzed. The impact on global supply chains already seems to be devastating. There's a potential cascading waterfall effect. But here's the good news, they say. The globalists, who just like they blamed Brexit for all the things that they've been doing for a long time, and just like Obama blames his predecessor, well, now they've got yet another excuse on which to blame the unexpected slowdown. Yes, we are data-driven, said the Fed just last week, and the data is going to be really ugly. Now, they helped to cause it, but at least now we've got another scapegoat. Economic growth and productivity in the third quarter might be impacted by this completely unexpected event. Unexpected, my you-know-what, right? We have been talking about the Baltic Dry Index, worldwide shipping, trucking sales, the fact that the world trade is literally coming to a halt for at least a year. No, actually longer than that. This has been a long time coming. The process began in earnest in 2008, and the so-called recovery has been a lie ever since. The data, if you look at the actual data, as opposed to the stuff that gets made up and foisted on people, has been saying this. So, do you think the Fed could have expected this? Darn right. And guess what? Hanjin is not the only one. We're going to see more. We've seen Maersk, the biggest shipping company in the world, announced similar things. We've seen shipping rates for containers go down dramatically. That's part of the reason why this company went belly up. But wait, there's more. Here's the rest of the story. This is why this one is so interesting this week. The Wall Street Journal is pointing out that the retailers that are being impacted by the fact that their stuff is not going to be allowed into the ports, we'll come back to that in a second, sitting out in the ocean somewhere, just kind of in a holding pattern. Now they're petitioning their gods. Ha! You see the connection? They're petitioning for the god of government to bail them out. Because Christmas, the biggest pagan season, is coming up, and the toys aren't going to be on the shelves. Oh, good God, what will we do? Come to us. They're praying to their gods. Save us. Oh, almighty gods of commerce of this world. Print some money. Print some fake stuff. Show me the fake money and deliver it so that we can be saved from the things that, well, if we'd been paying attention, we should have known were coming. Or America's banks would say they too need to get bailed out. Pray to the fake gods. Sandra Kennedy, president of the Retail Industry Lenders and Leaders Association, rather, maybe there's no difference, says the prospect of harm is significant and apparent. All kinds of bad stuff may come down. Here's the interesting part. The clogged supply chain chaos is already spreading. Wednesday, after the company's request for bankruptcy protection. Now, they requested bankruptcy protection in South Korea, where they're headquartered. But the implications, the ripples, are far wider. They include terminal operators, ports like the west coast of the U.S. primarily, cargo handlers, truckers, longshoremen, all kinds of people who have refused to handle or allow the ships to dock in port or to unload it because they're afraid they won't get paid. That's causing turmoil at U.S. ports and beyond, all the way as far as China, Canada, Spain, and elsewhere. With shippers, importers, freight forwarders, U.S.-bound cargo has been delayed not only at the ports but at the point of origin because all these cargo-laden Hanjin ships are unable to get into U.S. ports and unload, and they can't go anywhere else, and there's other ships backed up at the ports. It's a mess, and it's cascading. Wall Street Journal said freight brokers in Asia said are 540,000 containers now expected to face delivery delays, and they could range from a few days to a month or more. But meanwhile, remember how we said one of the problems that started this off is shipping rates have been collapsing because there's a glut of supply. Well, guess what? It's amazing what a few days of global panic will do to the glut. In less than 3 days, shipping container rates have, in some places, more than tripled. Isn't that wonderful? See, we solved the problem by causing a global collapse. Shipping container rates went up from $700, said one importer, to over $2,000 a container. Some are saying much higher rates, $2,300 by Thursday. So there you go. That part of the problem, at least, is solved by just a little old. And you know what's funny? There were some stories when I first did this earlier in the week saying, oh, you know, unlike the situation in 2008 when all these banks failed and got bailed out, what's really unique about Hanjin is they actually declared bankruptcy. Imagine that. In the modern post-constitutional, post-biblical, post-free money, post-free trade world, they talk about free trade, but it's anything but, a company actually did something we haven't seen. They declared bankruptcy. And, of course, this will be used as a scapegoat. And the turmoil will only aggravate problems for retailers that are already in a world of hurt. The names may ring a bell, like Tarjay. They're in a world of hurt because they pissed off, a whole bunch of their customers who actually think that male and female, he created them, and they don't want little 5-year-old Janie going into a restroom with a 30-year-old pervert who thinks he feels like a girl today, or maybe he just feels like feeling a girl today. Hey, you don't know, and Target doesn't care. And a lot of retail customers have said, then we don't want anything to do with you. But nevertheless, Target is going to blame the retail shipping problem for what, in fact, some of their management has caused. Walmart, too, is in a world of hurt. JCPenney, clothing retailers in particular. Walmart spokesperson said, right now we're waiting to hear the final determination on just how all of this is going to play out and how big and bad the impact is going to be. Biggest hit may come to the $25 billion U.S. toy industry. Their spokesman says the ripple effect could be tremendous because all of this comes at the worst possible time as retailers are trying to stock up for the coming critical holiday shopping season. This would be a bad thing at any time, but, quote, it's a particularly bad time now for it to happen, said one of the retail industry leaders in a statement. Furthermore, litigation would be a disaster, too, because even a little company a few years back resulted in a bottleneck in the legal system, and it took years to play out. So, as bad as it is, if all of this goes to the courts, well, justice ain't gonna happen, and the problem will no doubt take a long time. Here's the history thing. In 2001, 15 years ago, a much smaller Korean carrier named Cho Yang went bust. They had 200 containers, is all. A mere 200 containers. A single freight forwarder, and it took 6 months just to get it unloaded at the ports. We're talking something that's much bigger and in a world that is much more interconnected. Furthermore, they're even saying the sailors on these ships could be stranded at sea for weeks. They've only got food and water for about 2 weeks, and nobody will extend credit to the company. So are they going to starve? Or maybe somebody will read the book of Deuteronomy, point to Ray A here and say, hey, maybe we need to get those folks some food. They could pray to the gods of the banksters, and perhaps that'll be the place where their salvation comes from. Anyway, the final thing the story points out is, remember, so far, Hanjin has only obtained creditor protection in Korea. But a lot of their ships are at sea. And they're going to have to go out and file bankruptcy abroad, especially all over Europe and the U.S., in order to keep ships moving. Those that are out at sea may face seizure and problems all around the world. So the chaos will grow exponentially as a result of today's ultra-sophisticated but ultra-interconnected and subject to massive dislocations. They call this a black swan, right? Just-in-time supply chains. It's efficient when it works, and it's a downright disaster when it does what it's doing right now. All right, let's see. I saw a question. I think I've probably already answered that about Christians and brothers and sisters. I think there are a whole lot of folks, right? Israel is the key. So the question was basically, how about Christians? How about this denomination, that denomination? Are they our brothers and sisters? And the bottom line is, well, yeah, if those of all of us who essentially are the descendants of Abraham, and it says that literally is just about everybody on the planet, probably everybody who's human on planet Earth at this point can find some blood of Abraham. We're told in Scripture that it is, in fact, through your descendants, Abraham, the whole world will be blessed. So I think the answer's got to be yes. But when our brother is in error, do we have a duty to warn him? Well, even the satanic hosts of this world, right? I joke about Amos chapter 4. Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh does nothing but what he first declares his intentions through, as he puts it, my servants, the prophets. And we seem to see that when it comes to the satanic host, they're bound by that same law. There's all kinds of examples. You can look at the book of Job. Satan seems to warn those people that he's impacting too, even if it's a little bit underhanded, and there's a whole lot of marketing sleight of hand involved. And my joke, right, just like Amos and the prophets of Yah, well, Satan does nothing but what he declares his intentions through his servants, Hollywood. So, as Yeshua put it correctly, we are all without excuse. Now, does that not mean that those of us who are walking in obedience to him in fact, don't have a larger obligation to the community, to the world? You bet. The watchman on the wall is supposed to blow the shofar. By our fruits, we should be known. But I can't make the choice for somebody else. So that's the key here. That's the reason why I contend the right answer is come out of her. And we're going to come back. One of the things I also want to spend some time on today is the Brit Hadashah portion that goes with this one as well. Comes out from John chapter 16. So I'm tipping my hand there. And that's going to be the remainder of this answer. How can we have both a collective and an individual responsibility? Answer. Scripture makes it clear. Choose life. As for me and my house, said the prophet and the leader, Joshua, Yahushua, the namesake, we will serve Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. We have a choice. I cannot choose for somebody else. Now, I do have authority over my house and those that have placed themselves under my authority, whether it's by birth or by marriage. That's the essence of covenant and some of those things. In other words, there is a God-given line of authority. But I don't have authority over the guy down the street. He makes his own choice. It does not mean that when it comes to nations that claim authority, rightfully or wrongfully, over the rest of us, that the things that Big Brother does don't affect us. We all know that's true. But on the other hand, I am not going to allow some servant of the satanic host to claim ownership of me because I serve another master. I've been delivered by a mighty hand. I may be in the world, but not of the world. All of these things are familiar verses. But I think as we go through what we're going through today, hopefully it'll be as clear or more than it's ever been, that it has never been more vital for us to make this choice, make it known, and by our fruit, make it very clear who we serve. So no, when it comes to the Romanized church and those that claim, oh, the Pope said it, I believe it, that's the end of it. Well, excuse me, great. But you're serving a different God. I choose not to go where you're going. You want to create a hell on earth? Count me out. You want to tell me that you serve Agenda 2030? This was the story this week from the satanic Jesuit Pope. Literally, out there serving another God. Not even science. I mean, if you're going to serve science, at least serve science that's honest. This is lying climate science that says man influences the climate more than any god, even the sun god. What a crock. Let's not get sucked into that lie, okay? But there are those that will choose to serve him. He's the vicar of Christ. Trouble is, it's just not the one that Scripture ever had anything to tell us about. Other than, you know, there will be a whole lot of Christ in that day, and many will be deceived. You can look in places like Matthew 24 and see all of that. So again, it boils down to idolatry and choose whom you will serve. We have a choice of law. Do not choose the gods of all the nations around us. And if you want to be real honest and blunt about it, that is the history of the Romanized, paganized Catholic Church. You got all these pagans. We're going to Christianize all of this pagan crap from Ishtar to Mithras. From sun god day and Easter sunrise services and bunnies and eggs to all the other stuff. And then during the Middle Ages, they decreed, actually it was after 365 AD, anybody that was still keeping the Sabbath of Yahuwah was considered anathema to the one true universal and Catholic Church, and later they started killing them. And they did it for centuries. And they called it later the Inquisition and other things, you know, the sordid, disgusting, satanic history. They put all kinds of things in place, adding to and subtracting from stuff that was in print and basically reducing it to nothingness. By your tradition, said Yeshua, you've made the commandments of Yah of no effect. And now you claim the vicar of Christ and you put on a Dagon fish god hat and tell me that somehow serves him? The hell with you, because that's where you're trying to lead those who are deceived enough to fall victim to the same old lie from Genesis 3. You can be like God, you won't die. It's a lie from the pit of hell, whatever you think that means. Let's go back to some of the other lies. I hope that's clear. We have an obligation. See, I don't march into the Catholic Church down the street and say, you're going to hell. No. They've made a choice. They have a choice. They have every right to make the choice. But as for me and my house, we'll make a different choice. If they see by our fruit that they too should make a different choice. Wonderful. Praise Yah. Welcome them. But so long as they are bound and determined to do things that Scripture says they shouldn't ought to do, we separate ourselves. We're not in the land. I don't have the authority to kick them out. Now, I do over the fellowship that we have here, and we will. People assemble here on the Sabbath voluntarily. They can enter the room. They can leave the room. They don't like what they hear. Thanks for coming. May Yahuwah bless you. And if you need to, move on. All right, let's talk about some of the things that are happening in the world that is, in fact, working hard to foment a civil war and an economic meltdown and make damn sure that they have a Hitler on tap ready to step in and make a good old Adolf look like a piker by comparison. This story came out actually late yesterday. Smoking gun, it says, as if this is going to make any difference. The FBI reveals that Hitlery could not recall briefings that she was given about all this confidential stuff because she had a clot due to a concussion. Now, this is funny, and you have to put about three pieces together to recognize just how big of a whopper this one is. All right? Goes like this. Now, the irony here is, of course, that if you look and you read the FBI statements from the satanic leader there, James Comey, who basically said, you know, I'm scared of her. I don't know any prosecutor that would indict Hitlery who wants to live, you know, in this world. And then he went out and laid out all of the reasons why, in fact, she's guilty of multiple felonies and treason, and they're not going to bother with that. And now, listen to what this headline says. Smoking gun, FBI reveals Hitlery, and I'm pronouncing it correctly, of course, could not recall the briefings that she was given about what constitutes confidential information and how you, as what's your title? Oh, yeah, Secretary of State. You'd think she would be held to a higher standard. You'd think she know what confidential means, or eyes only, or top secret, or any of those trivial things, right? A little midshipman, 19 years old. On a submarine or a boat, knows better than the Secretary of State? Who are we kidding? But get this. Title 28, United States Code, Section 2071, Part A, says that any person who willfully and unlawfully conceals or removes any document, proceeding, map, record, paper, yada, 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 or email of such things, and puts it where it shouldn't ought to be, is guilty of various kinds of crimes with huge fines, up to 3 years imprisonment. And of course, here's the key part that some point out, they are therefore to forfeit whatever office they were in, and they are banned from ever holding any office under the United States in the future. Now, that's not something we're hearing, is it? But get this. Here's the funny part. This is why I started with, you know, the politics part of the fake gods with this one. I mean, we already know she's above the law. The law is for peons, not for those who are, in fact, gods by their own admission and plan. What's a god? A god is above the law of the various gods. You look at the Roman gods, the Greek gods, they were fickle. They're capricious. Hey, doesn't that describe exactly what we see out of Washington today? The FBI is essentially saying that Hitlery is excused from being criminally incompetent to hold office because she is mentally incompetent to know what she did wrong. Isn't that I mean, this ought to be hilarious. This is the kind of stuff that if we had honest late-night comedians reading the news, like whatever their names are, they'd be saying, yeah, isn't that funny? FBI says she's not criminally competent or capable of being held to answer for her crimes because she's mentally incompetent. So what do we do with her? Well, let's put her in the Oval Office. We're better. There's a line. There was a joke. It was an ethnic joke. I heard it, right? Fill in the ethnicity here. And it's these two drunk people of a certain ethnicity. And they've got a third guy who's drunk, but he's so drunk he's passed out. And the two drunks are describing their friend, and they say, shall we throw him in the back? No, he might suffocate in the trunk. I know. Let's let him drive. All right? That's what we're seeing with Hitlery. She's too stupid to know what she's done that's criminally wrong. So let's let her be the president and make the laws whatever she wants them to be. She's as qualified as anybody can possibly be on that score. Who can argue with that? Now, here's this one. I'm going to actually... a piker? Oh, a piker. A piker is someone who's kind of a skinflint, a cheapskate. In other words, someone who looks minor by comparison with the one we're talking about. Okay, so in other words, Adolf was considered to be a bad dude, but literally, who are we kidding, right? If you see the level of evil that is being contemplated today, and I know this is going to upset some folks. There's an old joke on the internet. Oh, you want to lose an argument? Make the inevitable comparison with Adolf Hitler. You lose. And the answer is, you know what, folks? There comes a time at which you have to say you need superlatives. If we are truly approaching a scripturally, you know, cataclysmic event, in other words, a crisis of truly biblical proportions, then eventually there comes along somebody who makes Ahab and Jezebel the major demons of Scripture look tame by comparison. I think it's clear we're talking about a Jezebel that is running for office here, and that arguably the kinds of things that are being planned make the final solution of Adolf Hitler look kind of tame. Hitler wanted to kill what? All of the Jews in Europe, starting with Germany, working into Poland and other places. He called it the final solution. What is it that the George Soroses, and yes, all of those other people, the Bill Gates and the others with their foundations and their revealed emails and their Georgia Guidestones and their eugenics plans and their openly admitted desire to reduce the global population to, oh, a half billion or so, what is it they're planning? They're planning something that, if you just come right out and admit it, makes Adolf look like a piker by comparison. He wanted to kill millions. They're talking about killing 6 or 7 billion people. Now, I don't quite think they'll get away with it. I think the God of the Bible is talking. We see various prophetic things that say maybe a third of all the people. Okay, that's not 6 or 7 billion, at least not at current population levels. But no way you can deny that what looks like it is in plan. And the reason why I call Hitlery Hitlery is because when it comes to the central tenets of Adolf's faith, she's right on board. She's a gun banner. She wants to implement the most radical anti-Second Amendment, anti-Bill of Rights plan ever. She's already said that within her first 100 days, she's got some great plans to disarm the peons of America. The only people that will be armed are her bodyguards, essentially, and of course those that enforce the new final solution to come. We're talking about Monsatan, a company that is literally trying to kill people worldwide with Frankenfoods, with control of agriculture. And it's percolated all the way down to where you've got little municipalities in the Miami area, and not just limited to there, but lots of places, saying, you peons can't even grow food. If Monsatan wants to feed you crap and force you to die and your digestive systems and your immune systems and everything else to shut down, well, we don't want you having an alternative. How dare you think you can grow ugly vegetables in your front yard? We're going to feed you that tree with the bite out of it from the backyard. And we're going to poison your crops, and we're going to rain down terror from you on above. No, there's no question about it. We're talking, and that's kind of the point. Why is it that the Creator says idolatry? Don't put these things in the position of being idols. And here we've got Americans saying, oh, that was old stuff. Why was that so attractive in Old Testament times to worship these other gods? We got gods today that make loci, Satan, Jupiter, Janus, you name it. Again, look like pikers by comparison. These are gods that are openly talking about killing billions. And oh, by the way, running off to their hidey holes when they destroy the entire planet along with it, too. This is a level of evil, folks, that you know, it has not been hidden. Hollywood has telegraphed it. Look at the worst disaster movies and Independence Day and everything else you can think of. Are we that far away from the alien invasion being unveiled, right? You name it, we're heading towards a climax, just about any way you can slice it. Now, I'm actually going to talk dates in a minute here, at least to the extent of revealing some things that others are now openly talking about. And it's kind of fascinating. Lots of ground to cover. Oh, I mentioned this story. Let me finish this up, and then we'll go on to some other places. Smoking gun. FBI reveals that Hitler is excused from being criminally incompetent because she is, in fact, mentally incompetent and has been for a long time. But, wait a minute. Now, I'm going to say this. Forgive me, but I'm going to read it because, have you ever heard that the last two words on every single black box recording from an aviation accident are these very same two words? You know what I'm going to say, right? This is called from Zero Hedge. The headline says, the oh shh moment. Hitlery wiped her server, we've talked about this just last week, with bleach bit. This is not just any old destruction of records, no. When something truly, really needs to be destroyed and never revealed. The line from the Wicked Witch of the West and the Munchkins, right? She's not only merely dead, she's really most sincerely dead. Well, that's what Hitlery did with her emails. Yes, NSA no doubt has them, but remember, she's above the law. They're not going to be revealed by no such agency. So she used bleach bit. We know all of that. Here's the oh shh moment. There's a whole timeline in the story here, but the headline gets it. Is it six days or six weeks? Anyway, after she was subpoenaed by the United States House of Representatives for the records, that is when the bleaching of the bits occurred. She was caught. She knew it. She destroyed evidence. And it was willing. It was culpable. It wasn't negligence. It was evil. It was, unless you're a, you know, god of this world, it would have been considered criminal and even treasonous. Oh, well. There's all kinds of evidence. I got six pages of all of this. Six days after the subpoena, the server was wiped clean with the best technology they could lay their hands on. All right, we switch gears slightly to other criminality. And this time, here's where we get some of the dates. Deutsche Bank, biggest bank in Germany. Widely considered by some folks, Jim Willey's one of my favorites, but he's not alone. Deutsche Bank, they think, will be the international Lehman moment. When Deutsche Bank finally breathes its last and goes truly belly up, it's died about a dozen times, but they keep putting the paddles on it and resurrecting it from the flat line, and it comes back. Or maybe it's like the undead. Some say zombie banks. There's a term. All right. Anyway, this week, the latest criminality there is somebody actually said, you know what? You claim I have gold on deposit. Here's my bank receipt for this gold. It says I own this bar and this bar and this bar. I want it. Deliver it. That's what the contract says. On delivery. Deutsche Bank says, not so fast. You can't have it. And it turns out that there are other clients involved. There's one called Extra Gold, a client of a German exchange-traded commodity fund, and others involved. Who's got it? Right? The technical term to obfuscate theft is called rehypothecation. So it works like this, you see. Somebody breaks into your house, they steal your TV. They take it out, they fence it to the local, quick fingers, a repo shop, who sells it to a consumer, who takes it somewhere where it gets stolen again, back to the same shop, they fence it to a third party. Everybody's got paperwork saying, I bought this from so-and-so. Who owns the TV? The guy who stole it first or the guy who stole it last? Ha-ha, well, this is what's happening with the gold. Basically, it's supposed to be in a vault, but somebody that owned the vault sold it. Not once, not twice, but according to most recent numbers, about 100 times. You got about 100 people owning every single ounce of gold in the various vaults worldwide. And every time gold looks like it might go up a bit, they sell a few more ounces because, hey, it's already paper gold anyway. Who cares? So this week, yet another aw-shh moment when somebody said, give me the gold. Show me the money. And the answer is, you can't have it. You can't see it. And now the usual suspects are pointing the fingers. He's got it. No, he's got it. No, he's supposed to have it. No, he said I was supposed to have it, but he hasn't got it. Where is it? So, Deutsche Bank has been offering explanations, not the first time, for why they aren't going to deliver what they have ironclad contracts to deliver. All of this, as you might suspect, says Zero Hedge, led to even more embarrassing questions and even more public outcry in Germany, which may explain how come, well, they just keep digging the hole deeper. We'll just leave it at that. But the question is, when, oh when, will the generally dumb public figure out that they've been had? And others have said, you know, Ron Paul, for example, former congressman, ran for president twice. As long as I've known the guy, and that's been years, was talking way back then. I was doing shows and interviewing him back in the Y2K time period, that there needed to be an audit of the Fed because they're supposed to have 8,000 tons of gold. Remember all this stuff that Goldfinger showed in Fort Knox back when people believed the gold was really there? Well, he's been talking about an audit for a long, long time. There has never been one. And just about everybody that knows what's going on says, come on, who are we kidding? The gold isn't there. And even if there was some gold there, it's been rehypothecated more times, you know, than you can count. Which brings me to this piece from midweek. Another guy in the gold industry that I admire, John Embry of Sprott, told King World News that all of the market manipulation we're seeing is a desperate attempt to keep confidence alive in a failing fiat currency system. Oh, can we do it through the election? Jackson Hole has come and gone. That was the big meeting of the criminals, the gods from Mount Olympus. Little of substance emerged. These are the very people that got us into this mess, and they're just producing more garbage. Labor statistics came out this week. They were embarrassment. They're an utter embarrassment to rational thought. They sold billions of dollars of paper gold on COMEX in 2 minutes a week ago, but don't worry. Again, it couldn't be delivered either. Price of gold was down. All of this is going on behind the scenes. Okay, I mentioned a couple things. There is a date that I've talked about before that has to do with a company called ICON. It's an international body, at least that's what it is now. Used to be run in the United States, and it was responsible for basically the heart of the World Wide Web. The naming conventions, the domain name services, all kinds of things that had to do with the tech of keeping the web going. And the regime in Washington, which promised, of course, that this would never happen, but you can keep your doctor too, has announced, and now it's come and due, that on October 1st, the World Wide Web will be turned over to International Big Brother, kind of a UN for the web. And the idea here is that if you thought that, Facebox and Facebook, Faceplant is what some folks are calling it now, and Google and other CIA and Big Brother controlled entities were bad, and that the censorship we've already seen was bad, just wait till October 1st, or maybe a few days thereafter. But maybe really it is October 1st, because here's the other news. This has to do with the economics. This had to do with Han Jin, the shipping situation, and the stock markets. Can they keep that propped up? And will Deutsche Bank, blow the whistle on the international gold markets? And will the COMEX collapse? And will there be delivery failures and cash settlements and all that kind of stuff? All this has been talked about for years. The question is, when do the wheels finally fall off the wagon and the axle digs into the mud? Jim Rickards, fellow who's written some books about gold, and I don't always agree with Jim. He is supposedly former CIA and has some good connections in Washington, so I listen to what he says, carefully. He claims that the fiat dollar implosion that everybody knows is coming will happen. Are you ready for this? I love people that are specific. Even if they're wrong, at least you got to admit the chutzpah in naming a date. So Jim Rickards not only names the date, he tells you when it's going to happen. You ready for this? September the 30th, 2016 at 4 p.m. I think that's Eastern time. Is when the implosion of the dollar will happen. At the close of the markets on the East Coast. Now, by the way, this weekend, even as we speak, in China, the Chinese are hosting the G20 meeting of the world's central banksters and other federal criminals, the gods of this world. They're talking about China's intent to join the international basket of currencies run by the IDF. All of this is supposed to happen on September 30th when the market closes. So that's why Rickards has picked this date. He says that is the day the dollar dies. Stick a fork in it. September 30th, 2016, 4 p.m. Now, you heard it here. I'm not claiming I necessarily believe him, but I do think you have to at least put that date on your calendar and say, well, we'll watch it. Now, why do I mention that? And why, in the same breath, practically, as I did the international takeover of the World Wide Web? Because guess what? Aren't these folks clever? That's the very next day. This is 4 p.m. on a Friday. The very next day, the World Wide Web takes over internationally, and you may never even hear about it. Wouldn't that be special? How clever they are. So you got to admit, you know, there's a line from the A-Team. I don't remember what the guy's name was. I can picture his face. Said, I love it when a plan comes together. Well, the gods of this world are working hard to make sure everything comes apart. Now, I also note one other thing, and that is that the first presidential debate, ha-ha, I'll put that term in there and I'll say sick, because I don't know whether there'll be a debate or not. Some people are doubting whether or not Hillary will still be able to walk at that point or talk without foaming at the mouth or blabbering incoherently or whatever the case may be. So maybe the jig will be up by then. But that first debate is supposed to happen sometime close to the end of September anyway. So can you see how so much is coming together at this particular time? It really is interesting, to put it mildly. All right, here's a line from the 5-minute forecast. Now, this is, again, going to talk about some of these same kind of things. A cheeky question we got to ask, they say. We know that the employment numbers, so-called, have been manipulated forever. They've been made to look better than they really are for a long, long time now. Is it possible they could also be manipulated to look worse? We have to ask, it says, because it happened again. As first Friday of the month, the Bureau of Lying Statistics regaled us with their monthly job numbers. The wonks conjured 151,000 new jobs out of thin air for August. And that was rather less than the conjuring that was expected by the gods of the expert market analysis. They thought there'd be 175,000 fake jobs. Anyway, Bloomberg, one of the mouthpieces of the propaganda state, tried to put the best spin on it they could. They described the bogus numbers as, quote, steady hiring in the face of lackluster global growth. You know, these guys are clever. They get paid the big bucks for coming out with ways to make the tree of death look really, really appealing. Maybe that's true, says Zero Hedge, but it's equally true that it takes 150,000 new jobs each and every month just to keep up with the growth of population in the U.S. By that standard, the economy is not even breaking even. So, that's why the Obama administration decided it was time to squelch any talk of the Fed raising rates, which, of course, they're doing anyway. I come back to Yaakov James, the double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. We're talking about deception. They speak out of both sides of their mouth. Anyway, the persistent chatter has been the Fed wants to raise rates at least once this year, maybe in September. Now, I will contend they will raise rates in September only if they have decided to give up on slam dunking Hitlery, right? Because if they raise rates and the economy collapses, it's the economy, stupid. Probably Donald Trump will win. And, of course, probably the numbers don't matter anyway, and we'll come back to that. The point is, if you're going to sell that particular lie, you have to make it look like things are good. That at least is the conventional wisdom. So it would seem that if they come right out and raise rates and put a wooden stake in the economy prior to the end of that same month, right, September. What an amazing time frame. This will be an interesting one. Well, they're pretty well saying we're just taking off the gloves. We're giving up on the whole thing. We're just gonna roll totalitarianism out and that's it. So there's some more stuff that's interesting in this article here. But basically, the bottom line is these job numbers don't even matter to the policy wonks anymore because everybody knows it's a big lie. Jim Rickards, again, we're talking about the same guy that just said September 30th, 4 p.m. is the date. He says this linkage that the Fed keeps talking about, they assume, a linkage between jobs and inflation. Well, clearly it's completely broken down because now the Fed policy is all about achieving inflation. They claim their sweet spot is 2.6%, but they're stuck at 1.6% by their favorite measure. Now, of course, people know that their favorite measure is a lie, too. If you look at things people actually need, like food and energy, even health care, it's a lot higher than that. So he says this, and this kind of goes back to his prediction. The fastest way to achieve inflation in a deflationary environment is to engineer a weaker dollar, which is what they expect. So there'll be some behind-the-scenes maneuvering going on to accomplish the weaker dollar right now. G20 summit in China happening this weekend. And that maneuvering will set the stage for the big event that he's still talking about at the end of the month, when the world money being schemed by the global elites will take a big step toward supplanting the dollar as the world reserve currency. There's that date again, September 30th, 4 p.m., 28 days from yesterday. I mentioned the Han Jin thing. Essentially, if you want an indication of what can happen when the wheels come off the wagon, remember, bottom line, one bankruptcy, not of the biggest shipping company in the world, but just number seven, 8% of the U.S. import from Asia by ship through this one company, 8% whack, and the price of shipping by containers went up by a factor of 3, not in a year, in a week. There's some inflation for you. It can happen dramatically and quickly. And I've joked now for several years, probably you've heard me say it here, that most Americans won't wake up to what's happening until the shelves at Walmart are empty. Are we there yet? No, but we saw at least another shot across the bow this week. All right, which brings me to this. I'm going to ask the question, as I often do. Give me a 1 if you've heard about this, a 2 if you haven't, and it goes like this. Why is the DHS, that would be the Department of Octung Homeland Security, one of the gods of this world, they will tell you which gods you're to worship, and they will tell you what Homeland Security means, your papers, BITA, although there is no BITA in the United States anymore, it's just a demand. Why is DHS preparing to take over the U.S. election, too? So if you're saying, what did he just say? Put a 2 up on the screen while you're thinking about the question. If you know what I'm talking about and where I'm seeing this, put a 1 on the screen. So if you've heard about DHS taking over not just the airports, not just the stock markets, and not just about everything else, but also the U.S. election rigging coming up, put a 1 on the screen. Again, otherwise a 2. Now the story actually came, there's actually a couple of stories that make this point. Washington Examiner is one of them. Zero Hedge is an aggregator. They will basically put stories together from all over the place. That's the place I usually go first. That's where I saw this headline. And I like their commentary because they seem to have a similar sense of humor to yours truly. What do? They ask, when you're the dictatorial leader of an oppressive government regime looking to maintain power, you know, your godlike power, while simultaneously attempting to preserve the facade of free and open elections. Well, if you're the Obama regime, you look for avenues to nationalize everything, including state-run election infrastructure. And of course, here I quote the Wicked Witch of the West. Seems like a lot of the Wizard Oz is appropriate today. These things must be done delicately. So, you need an excuse if you want to take over the election, because there would be some of them right-wing extremists, probably sovereign citizen, constitutional Bible thumpers, and other folks that still think the rule of law ought to matter. They'll think that this is done with some kind of right-wing extremist conspiracy theory motive. In other words, who could imagine? They don't trust this particular set of gods any more than we can throw them. So you need an excuse. You got to do it delicately. For a blatant power grab. Thus, this week, we had the FBI. Now, this is the same FBI that can't see treason when they're holding the emails in their hand, and they're looking at the woman that is too incompetent to be tried for treason, but is just fine to drive the ship of state, in spite of her mental condition. Yeah, they can't see treason there, but they smell a rat. Vladimir Putin must be trying to take control of the U.S. election. So, yes, they have said that foreign hackers may be penetrating state election systems, so they've warned, and that, of course, is all the excuse that DHS may need to take control of, quote, critical infrastructure. Now, this is a common technique. You say that something is really important, so therefore, you must control it. And the more incompetent you are, the better a reason you have to control it. This is the same DHS, by the way, that controls the financial sector and the power grid. Now, this is funny. This is the line from the Washington Examiner and Jay Johnson, the head of Aktung Homeland Security. Earlier this month, he said the following, quote, "We should consider carefully whether our election system, our election process, is critical infrastructure, like the financial sector, like the power grid," unquote. Now ask yourself this question. The U.S. power grid is probably at the most vulnerable it has ever been in the history of the U.S. power grid. A single point of failure is what they seem to be trying to engineer into place. Put all these back doors in, similar systems, so that terrorists, having broken into one, can get to all of them. So it's now vulnerable to cyber attack. Well, that's what happens when you design all of these back doors into all the operating systems and stuff, and you engineer the tools at taxpayer expense to take them all over. And, of course, then the Chinese and all the other hackers in the world, including the North Koreans and just about every other terrorist that you can name or, as the case may be, fund, has the ability to take down the grid. And let's not forget certain people, Dr. Vincent Pry, who's been warning about the vulnerability of the U.S. power grid to EMP for years, has said all it would take is a couple of billion dollars. We spend more than that when a Department of Defense general sneezes nowadays. Did you know the DOD has lost $6+ trillion? With a T? They have lost and cannot account for over $6 trillion. But the same DOD says that if the U.S. power grid goes down, 90% of Americans will be dead in a year. So we lost $6 trillion, but we can't afford to spend $2 billion to protect the lives of 90% of all Americans that are dependent on the power grid. So what do we need to do? Yeah, give the incompetents who can't fix the power grid control of the election as well. I've said this for quite some time now. Are these people truly, cataclysmically, literally world-class stupid? Now I got to quote Forrest Gump. Stupid is as stupid does. No, nobody could be that stupid and be in a position of power. So the only other choice is evil. I keep coming back to the theme. Behold, you got evil running the railroad. All those twos. That's for the question that I asked some time ago. So a lot of folks had not heard that the Department of Aktung Homeland Security wants to be your election slam dunker. Is it a surprise? Do you really think the election is going to matter? Well, the election is going to matter. It's just that the votes aren't going to matter. Then there's this. Now, this actually comes from a waste stream major media source. That's part of why it's interesting. Not that the conspiracy theorists are out there saying, hey, you know, as long as I've been doing radio, people have said, Bill Clinton isn't going to want to have an election. Well, he might not have, but he couldn't get away with it. Herbert Walker Bush, no election. That's what the leftists were saying then. And nowadays, people that realize that they're all leftists realize, oh, it doesn't matter. You know, there was the thing with Al Gore and the hanging Chad. Year after year, election cycle after election cycle, all of the people say there might not be another election. And my comment has been there hadn't been an election since probably Abraham Lincoln that didn't really amount to more of the same. Because once the Constitution turned out to be a dead letter and a roach motel, what else mattered? Back to U.S. News and World Report. Said this. A candidate's death, wonder who they're thinking of, could eliminate or at least delay the presidential election. Chaos would ensue if there was a vacancy that emerged between now and election day. The presidential election, the piece says, could be delayed or scrapped altogether if the conspiracy theorists were right and some candidate dies or drops out. Now, they've been trying to push the Donald Trump will drop out thing. That didn't get any traction. But it seems that the more times people look at Hitlery, see how she can't walk upstairs. The editorial cartoons are great. I saw a funny one the other day, Air Force One with one of those little wheelchair things, you know, the automatic conveyor attached to the ramp with Hitlery looking like a little Dalek from Doctor Who riding the wheelchair up into Air Force One. Okay. This is now mainstream. People realize that she is incompetent. And that's the excuse for why she's not criminally liable, because she's incompetent. But let her drive, right? So here's U.S. News and World Report saying, what if she dies? These scenarios have been seriously considered by few outside of the legal community, and they're perhaps too morbid for polite discussion in politically mixed company. But nevertheless, because we're telegraphing our moves, remember, Satan has his pundits, his prophets, whether it's Hollywood or the waystream media, and they're telling us, be aware, we're considering options for if we have to cancel or delay the election. I know. I've talked about that on the news show. Weekend with Bernie is another movie. We got all these movies, these Hollywood predictive movies. For those of you that don't remember Weekend with Bernie, and it wasn't one of my favorite films, I don't know if I could sit through the whole thing again, but I remember a couple of scenes. Weekend with Bernie, the idea is that, like Hitlery, this fellow Bernie is, I think, a mob boss, if I'm remembering right. The mob boss dies, and there's a couple of these idiots, right, dumb and dumber types, for some silly reason, which I don't even remotely recall, have to convince everybody else that Bernie is still alive. So the rest of the movie consists of sight gags, which some of them are pretty funny. The scene I remember is how they've got Bernie in the back of a speedboat. This is his corpse. Bernie's been dead for days. Bernie's in the back of a speedboat running up and down the shoreline with the two idiots driving the boat. One of them's holding Bernie's hand up, and Bernie's waving at the crowds. All right, so Bernie's dead, but we can't admit it. So, yeah, I'm not the only one that's joking about, is Hitler really dead already, right? They're carrying a mannequin up the steps in those videos. When she's slobbering at the mouth, that's, you know, ooh, let's not even talk about what it is that might be coming out. Who knows? The problem is, folks, we're literally seeing a parody, a farce play out, as the gods of this world have gone way, way over the cliff. It's almost, but not, well, yeah, it is. It's more farcical than the Aztecs and the Incas, right? They used to march their victims, the virgin, up to the top of the pyramid, and they would clutch people's heart out while it was still beating in their living chest cavity. And then the crowd would roar and say, this will fix it. Yeah, we sacrifice somebody else. This is what we've got going on. And people say there's no idolatry in the world today. They pray to the gods of Washington. If there's a natural disaster, if there's a hurricane, who do you pray to? Washington. They'll send FEMA. If there is a problem with your communications, you pray to Washington. They'll send an Obama phone. If the socialists have screwed up healthcare to the point where nobody can afford it, what will you do? You pray to Washington. They'll put Obamacare in place. And if you thought your premiums were high before, just wait. We'll have death panels because only the gods will decide who lives and who dies. And even the dead can still be president if they're above the law. And if, as Satan says, you will not die. You can be like God. I mean, you're looking for a proof of the fact that we've got fake gods? Look at the evening news. So basically, what the U.S. News and World Report is saying is, be aware, we're planning on this. Get this. Congress is up against a de facto deadline. Here's what they tell you. As if it still mattered, Congress has the power to change the election date under Article 2 of the Constitution, which is actually true, but I'm surprised somebody ever bothered to read it. And furthermore, it's conceivable that they could split various elections because even though they generally happen at the same time, they don't have to. They could split the presidency off. And if the entire election were to be moved until after January 3rd, though they do have at least a temporary minor problem, Congress would have effectively voted themselves out of office. In other words, if they delay the election for everybody and just say we'll do it in January, they're out of office at the point where they would stand for re-election. Now, the funny thing is that, you know, I wrote this in my margins of the story here. Is this an abdication? Is it de facto? Or is it just a confirmation that Congress has been essentially out of the loop for a long, long time anyway? We're talking about yet another thing that's just downright beyond the pale. I want to start to wrap up with this story. Now, I think it's obvious where I'm heading. I'm wrapping up the news part anyway. A Green Beret, Jeremiah Johnson, his pen name anyway, writes a number of places. I'm looking at a piece that was on Max Slavo's site, SHTF Plan. Jeremiah Johnson is the nom de plume of a retired Green Beret, Army Special Forces Airborne, and gives all of his credits here. Basically, he says, as I've written for quite a while, it's my firm conviction that we will be involved in a world war. I agree. That there will be an electromagnetic pulse weapon detonated over the continental United States, he believes. And then he says there's all kinds of things that pretty well make that clear. World leaders share that conviction. Senior military personnel share that conviction. Prominent analysts, all kinds of folks in the circles he's aware of are saying similar things. I've talked about, he's writing here about how the German government has warned its citizens, prepare for disaster, stockpile food. Berlin, they're bringing back mandatory conscription, talking openly about a draft because of the Muslim invasion that, of course, they fostered. Thank you, Angela Merkel. In Russia, they're talking about sending people to the underground mountain. It's called Yamantau Mountain in Russia, where they have the Doomsday Bunker. Russian reports say that the Russian Tu-22M3 long-range backfire bombers are now armed with the new Russian KH-32 cruise missile with the astounding capability. Can fly at altitudes of 25 miles, and when it reaches its target, the bomber can deploy, basically all kinds of nuclear weapons. The U.S. has deployed the THAAD anti-missile systems in South Korea against North Korea, the Sea of Japan, and nuclear-armed B-52s, for crying out loud, are back online in Guam. 75,000 U.S. troops have joined the Koreans there to stage military exercises. Bottom line, World War III is very close. He makes the point, North Korea, of course, has the ability to launch an EMP strike against the United States. The fellow that I mentioned before, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, has already talked about how the ability of the North Koreans to miniaturize warheads seems to have been demonstrated. They, last week, tested successfully a submarine-launched ballistic missile, August 24th, that traveled 300 miles, and that identifies their capability, even the DOD says, to feasibly strike the United States West Coast via a submarine launch. The Chinese did this all the way back in 2009. So none of this should be too surprising. It's just that meanwhile, Turkey has entered Syria. All this is alarming. The cat and mouse game. Dr. Paul Craig Roberts writes about how the U.S. is trying to literally piss off the former Soviets, the Russians, as badly as they can. And here we are heading towards an election, that might not happen at all. So be aware of it. Understand what's going on. This week, Obama tried to ban backdoor ammunition in the United States. They implemented by the same method that the DHS is planning on taking over elections. They redefined high explosives. For decades, ammunition makers have been shipping what's called wetted nitrocellulose. They literally put water in with nitrocellulose. They ship it, then they dry it out when they make it into ammo. It's been fine. But the ATF suddenly decided, oh, we're going to redefine the meaning of the word high explosive. And the industry was brought to a standstill by the mere change of a regulation, stroke of the pen, law of the land, and the, hit the fan. And within 24 hours, the NRA, ILA reported that the ATF had felt the heat and seen the light, and they backed off. This particular beta test was a failure. Problem is, of course, and I know, they're not done. They just tried it, didn't get away with it that time. That means they'll do it again later, probably during Hitler's first 100 minutes. So here's where we close. We start to end up today. I know there's been a lot of stuff to talk about, but it boils down to this. I mentioned Isaiah 66. I won't go through the whole thing because it's a long chapter, but I am going to do a little bit more of the introduction than I sometimes do. I do like, it's one of my go-to verses when it comes to understanding America 2016, indeed the world 2016. Thus says Yahuwah, begins chapter 66. Now, if you forget this one, what verse was he talking about? Where'd that come from? Just remember, it is the very last chapter in the prophet and the book of Isaiah. Last chapter of Isaiah. Great way to wrap it up. Thus says Yahuwah, heaven is my throne. The earth is my footstool. Where's the house that you'll build me? Where is the place of my rest? For all of those things my hand has made. Those things exist, says Yahuwah, but, now this ties in with the Torah portion this week, because there's some discussion in here about how we're supposed to treat the poor among us. No, we don't pray to the gods of Big Brother, the communist redistributionists, to say, we took it out of your paycheck. We are individually responsible, he says. But thus says Yahuwah, on this one, this is the one upon whom I will look, one who is poor and of a contrite spirit, now get this, and who trembles at my word. You think that applies to anybody? Well, 99.9% anyway in Washington, D.C. nowadays, are those that think that they're gods, that they sit on Mount Olympus, they go to Jackson Hole, they move and shake the world's fake money systems, they meet at the G20 in China, they plan on what's going to happen at 4:01 p.m. September 30th, or whatever the case may be. We're talking about a whole different group of people, those who tremble at my word. He who kills a bull, it's kind of like he slays a man. He who sacrifices a lamb, as if he breaks a dog's neck. He who offers a grain offering, as if he offers swine's blood. He who burns incense, as if he blesses an idol. Huh? How do you read all of this? I tend to think what we're talking about here is, well, a contrast between the fake and the real. The fake gods are the real gods. Between the idols of this world and the gods that think they run it, and the real one, who in fact is in the throne of heaven, and the earth is his footstool. Because he's talking about them in the very next line. Yeah, these folks, who are they offering their sacrifices to? Some of them don't even know they're worshiping fake gods, and yet they're in the midst of the worst idolatry, arguably, in the history of the world today. They pray to Washington. They pray to Brussels if they're in Europe. They pray to the World Bank. They pray when the shipping industry goes standstill because of things that the fake gods accomplish. They go back and they pray for a bailout. If there's an act of God in the form of a hurricane, well, even though man think they control the global climate, they'll blame that one on him at least. And of course, though, they'll still pray to the same gods. We need FEMA. We need a bailout. We need some FEMA trailers. Bring us some food. We can't be bothered to actually prepare, if we live in the middle of hurricane country, for what might arguably be inevitable. You ever noticed how when there's a hurricane forecast, the shelves are empty within hours? You'd think people would know, right? No. Just as they have chosen their own ways, I know you've heard this one, I've quoted it probably twice in the last week. Just as they have chosen their own ways and their soul delights in their abominations, he says, so will I choose their delusions and bring their fears upon them. Now let me pause there. What do you think a modern American is afraid of? Well, I know the football game gets canceled and the pizza delivery is late. But beyond that, could it be? Maybe the election will be canceled. I know, maybe it's terrorism. Maybe if we leave the borders open long enough and entice enough Muslim terrorists to come in, maybe my kid will catch some unfixable disease. I know, maybe they're afraid of Zika virus and we need a new vaccine. The God of medicine will provide a new vaccine for whatever it is that ails us. Maybe they're afraid their kid might get fondled at a Target. No, they're not afraid of that. They're afraid their kid might be exposed to bigotry of someone who's read the Bible. Yeah, they're afraid of that. I mean, we could go on and on. I've spent an hour just covering some of the things in the news. Just as they've chosen their own ways, though, and their soul delights in their abominations, so will I choose their delusions and bring their fears upon them. I guess at this point I'd have to say, hey, could there possibly be any questions that that's exactly what's happening? Why? Well, the next verse says this, because when I called, no one answered. When I spoke, they did not hear, but instead they did evil before my eyes, and they chose that in which I do not delight. Not only they chose that in which he doesn't delight, they went beyond the call of pagan duty. They chose those things he hates and said, do not do, in no uncertain terms. And he said, destroy. Burn down, utterly remove all of this crap. They chose it anyway. They chose that in which I do not delight. Hear the word of Yahuwah, you who tremble at his word. This is to us. Your brethren who hated you, who cast you out for my name's sake, said, let the Lord be glorified, that we may see your joy, but they shall be ashamed. Sound of noise from the city, voice from the temple, the voice of Yahuwah who fully repays his enemies. And he goes on to talk about some of that repayment. You know what? I'm going to talk about some other aspects of Scripture, so I'm not going to go through all of this in detail, because I think we're going to just see it. It's at hand. We'll get to see all of this. The theme that I led up, one of the themes of Ray A, was this idea of rejoice. Rejoice at, Xmas season, or Ishtar God, Sun God Day? No. Rejoice during His appointed times, the ones that are described again in this portion. The ones that the Romanized church said, you will be anathema if you dare to keep these Jewish feasts, you Judaizer, you. No. All of those are bogus, crappy translations. He said these are my feasts. Mine! What do we not understand about when He says they're His feasts? And keep them throughout your generations and all your dwelling places. We're supposed to rejoice. And that's what verse 10 says. Rejoice with Jerusalem. Be glad with her. All of you who love her. Rejoice for joy with her. All of you who mourn for her. That you may feed and be satisfied with the consolation of her bosom. That you may drink deeply and be delighted with the abundance of her glory. For thus says Yahuwah, behold, I will extend peace to her like a river. And the glory of the nations, the goyim, like a flowing stream. You'll feed, on her sides you'll be carried, dandled on her knees, as one whom his mother comforts, so will I comfort you. You shall be comforted in Jerusalem. Now there's some more interesting stuff in here. There's a reference to those who eat swine's flesh and the abomination, the mouse. They'll be consumed together. You see, in the end of this portion, this Haftorah portion, a lot of references to things that we're still told, right? All that's done away with. We don't worry about that anymore. Well, he says otherwise. All right, that brings me to the place where I want to wrap up, and that is with this discussion from the book of John. What? Yeah, one of the so-called Gospels. Gospel ultimately just means truth, Besorah. There's a lot of truth in this book. And it's not limited to a few things that people tend to pull out and say, well, the rest is done away with and doesn't matter. But if you actually read the part that, still does matter in context, make some interesting points. I want to suggest to you that this is a pretty good pick for the portion from the Brit Hadashah or the Apostolic Writings that goes with this week's portion. It's John 16, literally starts in verse 1. These things, these are words in red, this is Yahushua speaking, these things I have spoken to you, that you should not be made to stumble. He's warned us in places like, well, literally all the end times prophecies that we see here, Matthew 24 and others, about the deception that's coming. These fake gods, they tend to deceive. We're so deceived we don't even realize how many fake gods we got. So here, I have spoken these things to you, so you should not be made to stumble. Now listen to this. They will put you out of the synagogues. Yes, the time is coming that whoever kills you will think he offers service to God. Stop a second. That's about as on the mark as we're going to find. Now, we've been put out of the synagogues for a long time, most of us. And many of us that understand that the church is a pagan place, those buildings, those edifices, 501c3 tax-exempt corporate entities, faith-based institutions of another set of mighty ones, well, we've put ourselves out of those. But this is the part that I think is so key to understand now. The time will come that whoever kills you will think that he offers service to God. Which God are they talking? I think it shouldn't be capitalized here. They're talking about all the fake gods of this world. The trouble is, they don't know the difference anymore. Another Jesus whom we've not preached that did away with the law. You know, Christ incarnate, the vicar of Christ. All kinds of claims of people that basically know better than he did what he should have written if he was as smart as they think they are. Who are they offering service to? Bottom line is, I think most of them don't know. A lot of folks don't know who they serve, but hint, hint. They have been deceived. Their delusions have been chosen because they chose that in which he already said repeatedly, he does not delight. And then, these things they will do to you because they have not known the Father nor me. It's that simple. And by the way, if you do not know the Father, You cannot know the one who said, I come in my Father's name. Is it that hard to recognize? If you believe Hebrews 13:8, he's the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow, and Malachi said the same thing, I change not, then why would you make him to be a liar by saying all that Old Testament stuff is done away with? And for crying out loud, don't read Deuteronomy 30, because the law is too hard, and that's why we did away with it. Well, they don't want to keep the Torah, and the reason is obvious, because it says, don't worship them. This is not that hard. It's just that it's been hideously marketed right out of Genesis 3 on in the very same way. Isn't that a pretty wonderful fruit? Yeah, it brings death, but good to taste, looks good, tastes great going down. We'll sell you an iPod with that symbol on it. But these things, he says, I've told you, that when the time comes, you may remember that I told you about them. And these things I didn't tell you up front, he reminds those who are listening, because, at the beginning I was with you. But now I go away to him who sent me. And then he goes on to talk about the fact that when he is gone, it's going to be a bit tougher. And indeed, it got even tougher afterwards. He talks about the coming of the one who will bring this spirit. It's to your advantage, he says in verse 7, I go away. If I don't go away, the Helper will not come. If I depart, I will send him to you. When he has come, he will convict the world of sin and of righteousness and of judgment. Of sin, because they do not believe me. Of righteousness, because I go to my Father, you don't see me anymore. Of judgment, because the ruler of this world is judged, will be judged. And by the way, that process still continues. You're not ready to hear all of this stuff yet. And of course, I will contend one of the problems that we see with verses like this is people will say, oh, see, now I have the Holy Spirit. I don't need the Torah anymore. I don't need the law anymore. I'm not under the law. And you've heard my line on this for a long time. If your delusions have been chosen because you chose that in which I do not delight, and it's so clear what he does delight in and what he says to object to, destroy, tear down, don't for crying out loud even begin to believe in it. Deuteronomy 13 is all about the false prophet. Don't listen to him. If you got sucked into that and you got some spirit telling you, it's okay. You will not die. You can be like God. And the law's done away with too. I'll say it again. That may be a spirit, but it sure as hell ain't holy. At least it's not set apart to Yod Heh Vav Heh. So this is where you are. This is where we all are. Ask, he says, you will receive, that your joy may be full. Isn't that interesting? That's what we're talking about in this portion, is rejoice. I think it's fascinating, and this is how I'll end things, at least in the main part. If there's questions, get them up there, and I'll respond to them, hopefully. But it boils down to this. Throughout this portion, we see all of these things pointed out. We have a choice. Real simple, not too hard for you. Life and death, blessing and cursing. Yeah, the marketing of the death fruit is pretty darn appealing. It's part of the reason why the test is not as trivial as you might think, because there are those who would like to see you die. They're planning on putting 6 billion plus or so in that camp. And all of these choices have many, many manifestations. Slavery, charity, what do we do, when we do it, who do we obey? Still, same answer, choose life, choose his choice of law. And furthermore, here's the interesting part, if we do that, this portion too tells us, his feasts. Yeah, the world says they're done away with, the world's full of liars, don't believe them. But these are times to rejoice. That is the consistent theme that runs throughout the portion, rejoice. Offer these things, these sacrifices, when there's a place when we could do it in the land where he puts his name. We don't have that place today. We look forward to being regathered and to the time when we can rejoice and, you know, share this great barbecue. Meanwhile, we can memorialize it. We're still supposed to understand. And this is probably the hardest part. This is the thing that as I close today, I think, I understand that if we start to accept the lie, it's difficult to imagine how we could rejoice in the face of canceled elections and economic devastation and civil war and all of this stuff that looks and is intended to look really, really scary. But the commandment is the same nevertheless. Choose. Blessing awaits. Life awaits. And one of the aspects of that choice that also awaits is rejoice. Rejoice in Him. We can do this. And in fact, we must do this. If we want to be counted worthy to escape these things that are coming and to be regathered and to be, in fact, as we choose to be, I certainly hope that this prayer extends to all of us, that we would be good and faithful servants unto Him. So with that, we'll close in prayer. I don't think I see any other questions. Do I have any local questions? Nothing? Honestly, I look at this and I see the world and I see all these things going on. I am sometimes reluctant to use the term end times because people say, well, it's been end times forever. Well, it has. So are these the end times? The end of the end times? I guess we'll know in hindsight, because one of the characteristics of this rapid acceleration is that, well, as the acceleration accelerates, it always seems like things are coming to a head even faster than they were last week. And it was tough to believe last week. But hey, if we're talking about things that are truly of a biblical proportion, what would you really expect, right? So the answer is, we're coming closer. I don't claim to know how close. I quote people like Jim Rickards, September 30th, 4 p.m. Well, cool. But I don't think that's certainly not the time of His return. It's just one of those mile markers along the way that says, hey, if you hadn't seen it before, will this wake you up? What's it going to take? You've heard me joke for a long time about the various things that awakened yours truly to the fact that there really is a God. He really did write some things down for us. I call it the great big wind-up. He takes his heavenly 2x4 and whacks you right smack across the teeth with it. And then kind of says, are you listening yet? So how many times do we have to get hit with the 2x4? What's it going to take? I don't know. I pray this over all of our loved ones, and you've heard me pray this many times probably, that whatever it takes, that He will bless us with that. And we have loved ones that it may take more. So may He bless them with His chastening, with the 2x4 to the chops, with witnesses, with a wall thick with thorns, with a heavy hand, whatever it takes. Yahuwah Eloheinu, Yahuwah Echad, Abba, we come before You. And we know the time draws short. And we sense the acceleration. And Father, we just plain don't know exactly when and how all these things are going to pan out. But we know that You've given us Your word, that Your truth stands. We know that You have declared Your intentions through Your servants, the prophets. We thank You and praise You for that. And we pray that You would guide us. We know Your Torah is a lamp to our feet. Help us to walk step by step in the light of Your instruction as we head towards whatever it is that is the plan that You have for all of us and for each of us. Abba, we choose that we choose life. Help us to choose life in every way. Give us eyes to see and ears to hear that we may continue to choose life and to have it more abundantly through You and through an understanding of Your word, and that You are who You say You are. You were, You are, and You will be, and that Your promises, literally, we can bet our lives and our future and our very souls and spirits, nefesh, neshama, all that we are, all that we have, all that we ever hope to be, that we can trust in You. And along the way, Abba, we pray that You'd help us to be good and faithful servants. Draw us together to those who are Yours. Help us to come out and to be separate and to be not deceived. To know the times and the seasons. To be counted worthy to escape these things that are coming. And we pray, Father, that one way or another, whether it's before or after an end to our mortal lives, that we would see Your regathering and that we would be counted worthy to be part of all that You have planned for us, all of the blessings of Your appointed times to come. This we ask in Your name. We praise You. Hallelujah. Thank You, Abba. Amen.